You're listening
to a University of Kentucky
College of Arts and Sciences podcast. This podcast is from the 2013 Kentucky Women Writers Conference, made possible by the University of Kentucky. In this talk, Kia Corthron reads excerpts from several of her plays. She is introduced by Herman Farrell.
It is a great honor to come before you this morning to introduce Kia Corthron. Even though many of you have already had the opportunity to meet her in sessions yesterday, I want to thank Julie Wren and the Kentucky Women Writers Conference for giving me this opportunity to make this formal introduction and to participate in a conversation with this distinguished American playwright. Kia's work has premiered across the country in such prestigious venues as Going From West to East, the Mark Taper Forum in Los Angeles, the Minneapolis Children's Theater, Chicago's Goodman Theater, and our very own Actors Theater of Louisville, the Alabama Shakespeare Festival, Baltimore Center Stage, the Delaware Theater Company, and in Manhattan, the American Place Theater, Manhattan Theater Club, Playwrights Horizons, and New York Theater New York Theater Workshop. Also up in the Bronx, my home county, Sightline the Point, further up in my home, my alma mater at Vassar, at New York Stage and Film in Poughkeepsie, Yale Rep in New Haven, Hartford Stage in, well, Hartford, Huntington Theater in Boston, and I'm noticing no real love for Maine. and then across the pond to London at the Dunmore Warehouse and at the Royal Court. She's had residencies in Italy at the Bellagio and Siena Arts Institute, in France at the Dora Maar House outside of Marseille. And back on this end of the pond, she's been at the McDowell Colony. Her sister is on her way up to the McDowell Colony. We just talked about that. Again, that's in New Hampshire. Still no love for Maine. And she's had a McKnight National Residency in Minneapolis, Minnesota. Her awards are extensive. I'll list just a few of them, and these are all in your program as well. She had awards from the Kennedy Center, TCG, the National Endowment for the Arts. She's received a Writers Guild Outstanding Drama Award and an Edgar Allan Poe Award for work on HBO's The Wire. And recently, she won the 2012 Lee Reynolds Awards, Lee Reynolds Award from the League of Professional Theater Women. And she just completed a novel. We were talking about it when she finished it. Was that a year ago or 2 years ago, I think? I'll put you on. All right. And she was also an active participant in the Occupy Wall Street movement, and we'll talk about her activism as well as being a playwright. Kia is a member of the Writers Guild of America. She serves on the National Council of the Dramatists Guild of America, and she is an alumnus of New Dramatists. Kia was born in Cumberland, Maryland, in the Panhandle, not far from West Virginia. Her father worked in a paper mill, and her mother was a nurse's aide. She has two sisters, one a year older and another 16 years younger. And as I already mentioned, Kara Lee Corthron is also an extremely talented playwright. I know her work. She's an extremely talented playwright in her own right. Kia attended the University of Maryland as a creative writing major, and in her last year of college, she turned to drama and playwriting. She spent a year working with the playwright Lonnie Carter. I saw Lonnie in Chicago, so it was kind of fun to see that. Before she headed up to New York City to study at Columbia University School of the Arts under the mentorship of the legendary playwright, professor, and chair of the Hammerstein Center for Theater Studies, the late, great Howard Stein. That's where we met. It was at Columbia where I met Kia. She had written a stunning and beautiful play called Wake Up, Lou Reiser. And here I have to sort of go off my notes for a second and sort of tell you this little story. It was a Saturday morning, I believe, and I think I was assigned to be a stagehand. And it was the tech weekend, and I think it was, this time of year, maybe a little bit later in the year. I can't remember when, but it was 22 years ago. And I think my job was to help with the harness for a noose for an actor who would have to be lynched, hung, as part of the play. It's a play about the Ku Klux Klan. And my job was to convince this actor that he was going to be safe. And that was my total job, because I wasn't the tech guy, but I was the guy who was supposed to just calm him down. Because the way it worked was, it was a straitjacket. I don't know if you remember this. And there was a little hook in the back, and the hook was actually what was going to be pulling him up and lifting him up. Then there was going to be a noose that was then going to be put around his neck, and the noose had Velcro, and the noose was not connected to that other piece. But he still was not convinced. And I remember him saying something to the effect of, "Velcro, isn't that pretty strong? And that's not really going to break. And what happens if there's an emergency?" And then I suggested Scotch tape. And then somebody suggested, "How about Kmart cheap tape, something?" And then I remember Kia, I think that was probably the first moment that I met you, at the back of the theater, I think coffee in hand, in the darkened theater, yelling out, "Yes, he's right. Nobody dies in one of my plays, please." So this has probably been a lesson that has remained with Kia as she's gone forward in her career, because her plays over the years have invariably taken on subjects that, let's just say, are volatile. Wake Up Blue Riser, dealing with the Ku Klux Klan. Seeking the Genesis, dealing with guns and gangs and Ritalin. Breath Boom, gangs again, this time badass women gangs, and of course prison life in that story. Splash Hatch on the E Going Down, dealing with environmental racism and teenage pregnancy. Life by Asphyxiation, the death penalty. Force Continuum, police brutality, the NYPD blue, and also police brutality. I'll stop at this one. The Venus de Milo is armed. Landmines. But in all seriousness, Arthur Miller once described playwriting as an affliction. And he noted that this mark or curse or affliction of a playwright is that, and I'll share this with all of you, I'm sure we all feel the same way, is that we just can't make peace with the world. Now, from my time spent with Kia over the years and the few, unfortunately, too few moments that we've actually shared together, either on that stage at Columbia or in the writer's Gethsemane room at New Dramatists, or having coffee together just a few years ago or months ago, I can't remember, I'm getting old, at the Westway Diner on 9th between 44th and 45th in Hell's Kitchen, I can't help but think of Arthur Miller's astute description of our shared affliction, and I can fine-tune it for Kia Corthron, if I may. Channeling you yesterday, sitting in my backyard on a warm day in Midway, I actually heard you say, "I wouldn't mind making peace with the world if there was peace in the world." Did I hear you right, Kia? Yeah. The thing, though, about Kia's discomfort, disquietude, agitation, and yes, outrage with the world we live in and have lived in together over the past 52 years, we're 10 days apart. We're both born in May, 1961. I know, I just looked that up. So the thing about it is that Kia's inability to settle or make peace with all of this is that in her political activism and through her work, she not only shines a laser beam on the problem, but she never loses sight of the people, the children, the victims, and even, yes, the perpetrators, the humans. The humans who are trying to make their way through the chaos of their existence as a result of racism, sexism, economic hardship, and soul-deadening deprivation. She takes us as an audience into those worlds and the experiences of her downtrodden characters, and yet shows us, through them, that they seek what we all seek in the end, a way out of the chaos, a road, a path leading to a place of understanding and hope. Last year, I had the distinct honor of introducing the fierce Naomi Wallace to you. This year, let me introduce to you the fierce, formidable force that is Kia Corthron.
That was the best introduction I've ever had in my life. It's kind of, you're going back to New York with me. I'm going to take you everywhere. I'm going to read from three pieces, and I have a fourth, but I thought we're going to do a Q&A, so maybe I'll read it at the end, or if there's not time, I won't. So the first piece and I'll try. I'm trying to do all the characters. Is from a new play of mine called Megastasis. This is the very top of the play, Act One, Scene One. There are two young black men. It's night. Trey, who's 19, and Dubby, 20, on the corner, each drinking from a beer concealed in a brown paper bag. Trey chuckles whenever he finds Dubby funny. Trey's laughs are sincere but silent. Dubby speaks. Pot, meth, crack, coke, e-smack. Like that, like some mantra rhyme, this farm boy, Indiana. I ain't never heard of one dealer with that kind of inventory, like the damn CVS. And this ain't something he picked up since coming to the city. He was moving stock back in the cornfields. Pot, meth, crack, coke, e-smack. Sound of an approaching car. They look up, hide their beers, and at the sound of the car doors opening and slamming shut, they spread, lean against the wall, palms on the surface, legs apart, backs to the audience. Cops one and two enter, one patting down Trey, the other Dubby. When they're satisfied that the accused are clean, the cops exit, sound of the car driving off. Not saying I ain't had a toke now and again, but I never seen so many drugs till I got to college. I'm like, no, I got an anatomy final in the morning. Smoke that, I'll be confusing metacarpus with metatarsus. You ever drop acid? Trey shakes his head no. I done it once, first year, getting all my freshman curiosity out. Then going to this basketball game, I don't know what the score is. I just keep staring and thinking, wow, there's five players on a team, and I got five fingers on my hand. After the game, I follow my fellow heads to the park, and I proceed to write this 23-page essay on the mind-boggling numerical coincidence of my hands and basketball. And while my hallucinatory experience was an overall pleasant one, when I finally came down 12 hours later and seen what I'd accomplished, I thought, I do not have time for this nincompoopness. So that was my first and last trip to nowhere. My scholarship covers housing. I like the dorms, but if ever temptation dropped my average below 3.6, I'm taking my stupid ass back home. Commuter. Sound of approaching car. They hide their beers, spread them, are frisked by cops three and four. Dubby's beer is faintly visible. One of the cops points it out. Hide it better next time. The cops exit. How much you have when they nabbed you last year? Joint. Gram. Not even half a gram in that spliff. Look at y'all, you got was fined. You should hear Gina talk about it. You still ain't met Gina. Pre-law, me and her get married, doctor husband, wife attorney, like Bill Cosby on that show. Hood to bougie, one fell swoop. I read to Micah. I was in the bookstore. I saw a book with a little girl in cornrows, then a book with a little girl in braids. Then a little girl with a fro. Every time I see a picture book with a little girl, I think, maybe Mike could like that book. I go to the store for one book, come back with four. I show her the picture, follow the words I'm saying aloud with my finger. I heard that helps them learn to read. I know she's only 6 months old, but... No, cuz she is learning. Her brain making connections. You a good daddy. This boy from my calculus, Brett, lives at home, 10-room apartment. His parents away, so Brett invites me and a couple from class over Saturday night, play some poker. We're hanging, and this cop car turns the corner, so I spread him. What you doing, bro, them white boys ask, laughing. Cops drive on by, one give me a funny look. I'll take it, we got recycling on campus. Trey hands his empty bottle to Dubby, who puts it and his own in his backpack. As the sound of a car approaches, they look up, then assume the position. Then a couple girls come up and say, let's play. We go inside, and the poker plan changes. Brett sticks in a video game starring this Haitian drug dealer and this black prostitute and this black pimp. I'm like, hey, ain't that racist? And Pete, the one got a 99 last midterm, goes, anything's racist. If you paranoid, cops five and six enter and frisk them. So that's the end of that scene. And this is a scene that was actually inspired by, some of you may know the book, The New Jim Crow by Michelle Alexander, so which is about the horrible drug laws and the devastation to the Black community. So this piece, it's the first scene from a one act that I did called Trickle, a long one act, sort of long one act. I was in the fall of 2008. I was at Bellagio in Italy, and it was the time that the financial crisis hit, and I had to write a play with, I was commissioned to write a play with all women characters, so I wrote this. There's two characters, Jean, who's a white woman, and her secretary, Christina, who's a Black woman. And this is the first scene. A corporate office. Jean, calm, confident, half sitting on the front edge of her desk while speaking to her tense secretary, Christina, in a chair. This is Jean. Everyone jumps to blame the Republicans, and sure, Mr. Reagan flew into Washington with all sorts of deregulatory schemes, but our current situation, if you want to call it a pact with the devil, and I would not, but if you are so inclined, then be accurate and call it a joint pact. It was a Democratic president joining hands with a Republican Congress that repealed the Glass-Steagall Act. You're going to business school in the evenings, right? You've heard of the Glass-Steagall Act. The Glass-Steagall Act emerged out of the New Deal, mandating a separation of public commercial banking from investment banking, a lesson learned after the marriage of the two resulted ultimately in a crash, which resulted ultimately in a depression. So 66 years later, President Bill shakes hands with the Reds in Congress and repeals the act. Isn't that funny? I love calling the Red Party state the Reds. I like to tell people my position for smaller government, the free market, and a dismantling of the graduated tax system is because I'm a card-carrying Red. So, you know, there were the dot-coms, and that went really well till a little bubble burst. And then mortgaging. And while I don't wholly agree with the predatory lending practices that have left a few foreclosed families with their asses out on the sidewalk, I can't help but to consider that we do live in a literate society. Why didn't they read the fine print? And if they don't own a magnifying glass, they certainly could have snatched up an affordable lawyer among the infestation that have proliferated like rats in the subway system. But back to my point. I mean, for a quarter of a century, a lot of money was made. Who can call that a failure, an illusion? And this outrageous surplus, how could all of it stay concentrated at the top? Of course it trickled down. Reagan popularized the phrase, but don't forget, a decade before Reagan, banks went public. So, allowing everyone to join into the party, over time we accumulated this astronomic amount of capital to play with. And for well over two decades, we gambled all that money. And for well over two decades, we gambled all that money. And what did we get? Jackpot. And screw my damn yacht, my house in Italy. What matters is I could give my son and daughter a decent education pre-K on. So, what is that saying? Everything that goes up must come down? Naturally, the pendulum occasionally swings the other way. And this great overreaction, because in truth, if people continued contributing to the economy confidently, even the so-called crisis would blow over in a year or two. The panic is simply because this happened to be the most dramatic market plunge since we've been betting with other people's money. Yes, it dwarfs the 90s SNL debacle, but now, like then, we're protected. They call it a bailout. I call it insurance. Still, no system is perfect. My personal world would have suffered its own little implosion had it not been for the fact that 50% of the housing costs in my tax bracket were covered by the tax-deductible interest and real estate taxes. So, am I losing my job? Oh, no. No, no, no. Did you think that's why I called you in here? Heavens, how could I get along without my secretary? Administrative professional. Christina, you have no worries about job security. Christina is visibly relieved. Like I said, it all trickles down. That goes for the bailout as well. people mistakenly believe that only the fat cats are benefiting. The reason Congress originally rejected the bill was purely political. All 432 House seats were up for election the following month. Sure, let's make dire decisions based on the hysteria of the constituents. But when they finally stopped to listen to the professionals, I mean, who's on the NYSE floor every day? Us or some rep from Mississippi? Anyway, you are fine. Your position secure. Take yourself out to dinner and celebrate. Thank you. Oh, thank you so much, Jean, I thought. Well, you know we just bought that apartment and, yes, predatory. I think the mortgage payments were a little over our heads, but we're making it. Just making it. I was so afraid. Christina, you are not losing your job. Christina nods, humbly grateful. However, there will be some job loss. Others, you may be asked to relay a few of the messages. Christina nods. And among those of us remaining gainfully employed, a bit of belt tightening, in your case, 20%. You're cutting my salary 20%? Me? No. I fought tooth and nail. I'm not letting go of my secretary. Not an easy sell while so many colleagues were losing their secretaries. I won the battle, but compromises. Well, I'd better prepare for that Wiesenthal meeting. We can discuss all this later. Jean walks around to sit at her desk chair, immediately starts typing into her computer, no longer looking at Christina. Christina, seeing the meeting is apparently over, stands and walks towards the door. Then she turns around. Jean? Jean doesn't look up from her typing. Regarding the trickle-down theory, are you doing okay with your 20 pay cut? When you order my lunch, make sure they pack extra Tabasco. Yesterday, they forgot. That's the end of that. So, and Julie suggested, because there are so many among us writing in different genres, that I read a little from the novel. So this will be the last piece I read. I have one more that I could read at the end if we have time, but for now, I'll just read this. The novel is called The Castle Cross, The Magnet Carter, and this takes place in 1960. I pulled this scene, it's kind of in the middle of the book, but mainly because you would understand it out of context the rest of the book. And there's actually a lot of dialogue, but I promise I wasn't cheating and being a playwright and putting into it. It just, this scene has a lot of dialogue. So, okay. So it's 1960. The white entrance guard leans back in his chair, legs stretched, feet crossed and propped on his desk. His blue eyes glance up over his newspaper. Thought you were waiting for that gal. Though he's relaxed, he's not exactly rude. A Negro boy of about 12 sweeps the floor, empties the wastebasket. Behind the guard stand two flags, one representing the state of Georgia, the other the United States of America. She's 5 minutes late. I don't want to lose any more time with my clients. The impatient young attorney seems a bit perturbed with the tardy party. Beads of sweat appear on his brow, unused to heat like this in mid-April. The guard unlocks the gate, leading him down the hall. They come to a closed door on the left, another guard leaning against the wall next to it, absently smoking. Donnie, the entrance guard points his thumb in the visitor's direction. There's the lawyer. The guard throws his butt to the floor, stamps it out, and unlocks the door. The room is small, cramped, and uncomfortably warm with no windows nor fan. A rectangular wooden table and chairs. They are adult chairs, yet the four grown-ups stand while only the two little Negro boys are seated, their legs dangling. They work in coloring books. When the lawyer walks in, all eyes turn to him. The older child sits on the opposite side of the table facing the door, which the guard now closes as he exits. The younger's back is to the door, so he has to turn around to see the visitor. He is the first person in the room to speak. Are you Mr. Campbell? Yes, says Elliot, who takes off his hat and holds it in his hands. I am. The boy scrambles out of his chair to stand and shake his attorney's hand with the formality of the gentry. How do you do? The adults are Claudette and Ronald Price, the parents of 7-year-old Jordan, and Howard and Minnie Williams, the parents of 9-year-old Max. They introduce themselves to Elliot. Where's Dee Dee? Mrs. Price asks. Elliot is confused. Miss Wilcox. She must have gotten held up. Jordan's mother seems stricken, as if this is yet another bad omen. This is a fire truck, Mr. Campbell, says Jordan. Fire truck, I color it red. He makes a siren sound, moving his picture through the air. Can I wear your hat? Max asks, and Elliot gives it to him. Max puts it on, and it falls over his eyes. He giggles, then pushes it back on his head so he can see before resuming his coloring. This is a Dalmatian, says Jordan. The page is white, but white crayon make Dalmatian whiter. This is the fireman. Max make him pink, but I just leave him be. Like the page white, but not white like the Dalmatian. I traced it, see? I traced it. Look like the real picture, see? I see. What did you color, Max? Elliot takes a chair sitting on an end of the table between the boys. Train. Max had done a very studied rendering of an engineer standing outside a passenger car, kindly talking to a porter. Both men are pink. That's very nice, Max, but you know you could have made those men brown. Both boys stop coloring to look up and gape at Elliot. My father was a porter, like him, and colored men can be engineers, too. The children look down at their pictures, then back up at Elliot, blinking. Elliot asks gently, "You boys want to tell me what happened?" Max sighs, tired of this question, but Jordan jumps in, seeming to delight in this reversal of children should be seen and not heard. Whenever he tells this story, he has all the adults' undivided attention. "We was playing with Jenny Dodgson and Lacey Pike, and Jenny Dodgson's daddy's a fireman, and he the mailman, too, and I don't know what Lacey's daddy do. And Jenny go, 'How old is you?' And I say 7, and she say, 'I'm 7, too.' And Max go, 'I'm 9, and Lacey say, 'I'm 8, and Jenny say, 'You want to play dolls?' And I say, 'Dolls is for girls.' And she say, 'You want to play hide-and-go-seek?' And I say, 'Okay, 5, 10, 15, 20, 25, 30, and we find her and Lacey in the Stella Rose's bushes. And Jenny go, 'You want to touch my hair?' And I go, 'Okay.' Her hair's straight and yellow. And Lacey go, 'You want to touch my hair? It red.' And I say, 'Okay.' And Jenny go, 'I seen Bieber and Sissy Gompers kissing. Bieber's Jenny's big brother.' And Jenny go, 'You want to kiss me?' And she stick her lips out. And I go, 'Okay.' And I kiss her right on the lips. Beck! And she laugh. And Lacey go to Max. And Lacey say, I know how to kiss.' And Max go, 'Okay.' And Lacey go to Max. Beck! And we find a frog, and we pick up that frog, but it slip away, hop, hop. And we go home for supper and knock on the door, and Mama get the door. Then she go, 'Jordan, Ron!' And me and Daddy come running to the door. Her voice sound like we ought to come running to the door, and a police standing there. And policeman say, 'You kiss a white girl, boy?' Policeman look mad. Policeman say, 'Jenny tell her daddy we was kissing.' Policeman say, 'You know that's a white girl. You know that's a white girl.' And policeman got a gun in his pocket. He keep tapping it. And they put the handcuffs on me, click, and they put me in the paddy wagon, and Mama crying and me crying, and then they drive, and then they park. They park a long time, and then come Max and the handcuffs crying. They put him in the paddy wagon with me, his Mama crying, and in the jail, they punch us in the tummy, they punch us in the legs, in the back of the back a long time. Bang, 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 my tummy hurt. And every day we say, 'Can we see our Mama?' And they say, 'Should have thought of that when you go raping little white girls.' And then our Mama and Daddy come, and then the judge say, 'The reformatory.' So they send us here, the reformatory, and they make us pick the strawberries in the sun, hot, and they make us talk to the psychologists, and the psychologists say, 'You ought to be castrated.' And the psychologists say, 'You know what castrated mean?' And we say, 'No.' And the psychologists tell us." Jordan's eyes are filled, his demeanor completely changed, as if at the beginning of his narrative, his enthusiasm in having a new adult as a captive audience had caused him to temporarily forget his story's terrifying end. Elliot turns to the older child and speaks softly. "Now you tell me, Max." "Like he say." Max had continued to color throughout Jordan's testimony and doesn't look up from his task now. Elliot talks to the parents quietly a few minutes. They are interrupted by a quick knock, followed by the guard poking his head in. 2 minutes. He shuts the door. Mrs. Price wipes her eyes. "Come give Mama a kiss. Come give Mama a kiss goodbye." "No!" Jordan runs to his mother, throwing his arms around her legs. "I want to go home." She reaches down, embracing him. That's why we're going to talk with Mr. Campbell now, baby. That's what we're trying to figure out. You be a good boy, all right? All right, Mrs. Williams instructs. And she and her husband walk over to kiss Max, who never looks up, never stops coloring. May I have my hat back, Max? Max stands, takes it off, and hands it to Elliot. Then he stares up at his lawyer. Can I ask you a question? Of course. Elliot stoops next to the child, and Max cups his hand around his own mouth and Elliot's ear. When my mama kissed me, that don't count as rape, do it? It only rape when I kiss back, right? So that was actually, I fictionalized. I fictionalized it. It's 1960 Georgia, but it was actually a real case called the Kissing Case that was 1958 South Carolina. So these little children.
Well, I've got 1,000 questions to ask you, Kia, but I was racing through the order of questions after hearing the three pieces, language and politics. But I think I want to start where I thought I would start, which is going back into your childhood, if you don't mind. You come from Cumberland, Maryland, and from what I've read online about your beginnings before you went to college, that you were always sort of crafting narratives in your head, or as we like to say as playwrights, we hear voices. And so could you talk a little bit about what that was like and just what you remember of your childhood and how that has sort of stayed with you as a writer going forward?
Well, I used to talk to myself. My mother said my older sister was 15 months older. And she said I actually started it when she went away to school and I wasn't, didn't see her all day. But also my father worked in a paper mill, and one of the benefits he got from that, I'm not sure they knew about this benefit, but he was always bringing home reams of paper and pens and stuff. So I made little books. I was always making little stories. So, yeah.
I had the great good fortune this summer to interview George C. Wolfe, who's from Frankfort, Kentucky. And in doing research on him, I noted
he's a major theater director.
George C. Wolfe is. He was the artistic director of the Public Theater. He directed the initial production of Angels in America. He's just an awesome playwright. And as a playwright himself, he had written The Colored Museum, which was just a very important piece of American playwriting. But in an interview here in Kentucky, Bell Hooks actually asked him about coming from Frankfort and living in New York. And basically the question was, how has coming from one particular community and then going from it sort of influenced your work? So you're from Cumberland, from Maryland, very particular part of America, and yet you're living now in Harlem and have lived there for the last, 30 years. So can you just sort of talk about that?
Well, I would say that I don't have to yell anymore. My dialogue in my plays, and probably also the dialogue in my novel, I think it's a mishmash. It's neither completely rural, now it was a small town I grew up, nor urban, but I think it's a little combination of that. So you couldn't, I mean, of course, the actors with Megastasis, the first piece, would be bringing New York to that. And, you know, I lived in New York 25 years, so I hear that, but I also feel like off the page, and that's great, that they would do that, but off the page, I think that's one of the things, is that it's, I think my language is a little bit of kind of both together, a blend. And sometimes I write small town stuff, and sometimes I write very urban stuff because I've lived in both environments. So,
okay. Well, you've been quoted as saying that you begin with sort of a political impetus, and then
the plays, as I know from reading them, and those of you who are familiar with, become quite personal. Can you talk a little bit and share with fellow writers that sort of start? And I'm also interested in your research. And one of the things you talked about was how you do tons and tons of research. And I guess my question is, when do you know when to stop and when to go on to start writing the play?
Yeah, I do lots of it. I mean, some plays more research than others, but sometimes I can be kind of a research demon and sort of have to make myself stop. I always start with, I mean, the two most recent plays that I've written are Megastasis, the one inspired by the new Jim Crow. And the other one is, which is very brand new, is, which was commissioned by two actors. So it was really kind of a husband and wife acting team, so which I've never done before. And so it was really interesting because I had to have two main characters and two journeys. So it was kind of a great challenge. And that one is called Slingshot, and it has to do with tort law. So I did a lot of research with that. Tort law, which I'm sure Nancy knows because she's a lawyer, is it's lawsuit law. So what inspired me to do that is tort law is, lawsuits, it's the one area we're in a level playing ground. We're not because it's a jury of your peers. It's not politicians who may have special interests. And it can be a very common person against a big fat corporation. What's happened in the last 20 years, maybe even a little more, that there has been a manipulation in society so that suddenly this common person that suffered some major harm is greedy, and that's the poor corporation. And so the kind of the poster child for that, which I've talked about before, is the McDonald's case. And a lot of people, that woman became a joke. She was a 79-year-old woman. She was in a car. Her grandson was driving. They parked it. She just put the cup between her legs to put her sugar in. It spilled. It went through her sweatpants. She had third-degree burns. She had to have skin grafts. If you look at the pictures, their heart looks like she was burnt in a house fire. And, you know, people said, oh, but coffee's supposed to be hot. You're not supposed to be sent to the hospital in third-degree burns with skin grafts because it spills on you. And actually, all she asked McDonald's was to pay the part that Medicaid didn't pay, because she assumed they had insurance for things like this, which was like $10,000. And McDonald's said, we'll give you $800. So that's when the lawsuit began. And the play is not about her, but I'm just sort of as an example of how this has been manipulating our minds. As it turned out, McDonald's had 700 major complaints about two hot beverages. It seems like the reason is it's 50 degrees too hot, so it's like majorly too hot, because the shelf life lasts longer. If it gets hotter, then it doesn't taste bad longer. They get it. So finally, after this lawsuit, it's for the safety of everyone that the lawsuit, which hits a corporation where they live with money, is they started, it's the public safety. They started lowering the temperature. So that's that.
Okay.
I do go off in these issues.
I've always wondered about this, the sort of the role of theater when it sort of takes on political issues. I want to talk a little bit about, where do you think theater's role is in attacking these issues? I'm sure you're going to say we should be engaged, of course. But I'd sort of like you to address sort of the timing of this. What I mean by that is, we're living in an age where, every night we can watch Jon Stewart just nail it on a political issue. And those of us who want to write about a political issue find that, we've got to wait for the play to get produced, and that's 6 months or a year later, and the issue suddenly is not hot anymore, and people aren't focused on it anymore.
Do you find that to be problematic sometimes when you're addressing a particular political issue, that you're racing as quickly as you can to address it because it's something that's being addressed right now? But yeah, by the time it gets produced, I wouldn't say people have moved on, but perhaps it's not, you know, on the front pages anymore.
Well, I think about it, but luckily, racism doesn't seem to be going away, so I'm pretty safe there.
Yeah.
And I mean, in this play, Megastasis, I mean, New York just finally, at least for now, though Bloomberg is trying to change it, got rid of Stop and Frisk.
Right.
And this play deals somewhat with Frost. I mean, it's more, as you can see, this beginning scene, but as you probably all know what Stop and Frisk is yeah. And later it becomes more about the drug, but it was something and may, you know, in many places still continues. And I also feel like it's important that, to say these things, that we don't go back to those times, because it can easily be turned around. And so, I mean, like, you know, the first play I wrote, Come Down Burning, which has to do with abortion. I mean, that was a long time ago, but look what happened with backlash against abortion. You know, it's always, so those, unfortunately, those issues always come back. And I love that made up quote of me. That's my favorite quote of me that you made up, and which I cannot paraphrase it poorly, but what she said is, I mean, if the world were peaceful, I'd be fine not writing. It's like, I'm like, I recently had surgery and had to lay myself up, and I thought, that's going to be really hard because I can't write and da-da-da, and I just have to make myself not work. And as it turned out, I loved it. It was like, no writing. And it's like, so I'll be fine when everything's fine. I don't have to write. But in the meantime, I don't think it's going away.
Good. So can you talk to us a little bit about some of the writers that have influenced you?
You know, this is an interesting question, because when I was in school, somebody that I read, who I immediately liked his plays but didn't realize how much of an influence he had on me, was actually David Rabe in the Vietnam plays, particularly The Basic Training of Pavlo Hummel, which I'll never see, 'cause it's like 35 actors. But
I did a production of Streamers in college.
Oh,
so
really?
Yeah.
Well, Streamers, like, I saw a revival of that. I don't know how much of you know who are not playwrights, but it's a thing about paying all these actors, so playwrights are getting smaller and smaller, which is a whole other political issue I have specifically with playwriting outside of the general realm. But Streamers, I saw a revival. And there were like 9 actors. Okay, a couple of them were soldiers who came in with like 1 line at the end. And that would never get produced.
Right.
I mean,
for
a first production.
Without Joe Papp being.
Yes.
So other folks who have influenced
Well, you know, although I didn't find her much later, Adrienne Kennedy, who's a very surreal black writer, beautiful writing from like the 60s. I should say the reason that with David Rabe, while I like them, what I realized, how he influenced me, which I didn't realize it, is he takes very sort of gritty, real subjects, but then puts this in something sort of hyper-real, this hyper-real world. So it's not naturalism, but it's not surreal much, but it goes into this just hyper-intense place, and I think that because people sometimes say mine is hyper-realism the way I write, and so I think that's how that influenced me.
Okay. Well, I have a question here that I wrote down as I was running out the door, and my wife Nancy was talking at me at the same time, but it's a bit convoluted, so give me a moment here. But and it's tied to the language of your plays. And if I can, if you don't mind, I'm just going to read. We've already heard the wonderful language of Kia's work just a few moments ago. But this is from Breath Boom, just 2 moments that just kind of stuck with me just when I was reading them this week.
This is the play. It's a girl's gang.
Yeah, girl's gang.
So a young woman comment comes in, and her first line is, "So fucking sick of this. Thought kids I'd give up the life. Welfare sure don't cut it. I got a gangbang supplemental income for the luxuries, food, diapers." And then later on, in a later scene, Angel makes a comment about that woman. She says, and it's years later, "Run into Comet the other day, supermarket, big as a house. Invite me to her baby shower, Sunday. Wanna go?" And for the first time, is it Prix?
Pri.
Pri looks right at Angel and says, I ain't never in my life uttered a kind syllable to Comet. Now, why you think she want me at her shower?" I want to talk about your kind syllables, because there's such a wonderful rhythm to your writing. The literary manager at the Goodman Theater said that that your language has its own unassailable logic and its own music. Can you talk to us a little bit about, I mean, your very distinct style, how it came to you, how you discovered it, and what you yourself think of it as you write it down?
Well, I guess when I was in undergrad, the reason it came to me and why I didn't just write naturalism is my very first playwriting class, and something stayed with me, which was that plays are on the stage, so they're meant to be heard. So in a way to wake up your ear, I play with something that when the actors do it right, it should feel completely natural coming out of their mouths, to the audience, but also to the audience, you prick up a little bit because that wasn't quite natural. So it makes you listen harder because my plays can be kind of dense. And so the audience has to be an active listener or it can kind of go over their heads. So, and the awareness that people are going to hear this, it's not just reading on the page. Which is a different kind of music than a verbal music out loud, yeah.
Okay. Well, if you don't mind, let's talk about American theater. And
this is always a funny discussion because we're always, what he really means is let's bitch about American theater.
Here we go. So let me launch you. So one of the things that comments that I read online, and I share with you this comment, your concern, you know, let's talk about the simple things first, about just cast size, this notion that, you know, our canvas is going to be limited to five actors, five characters. What can be done about this? I mean, first of all,
I have an idea.
Here we go.
Actually, I'm slowly trying to. I'm on the Council of the Dramatists Guild, so I'm slowly trying to work it. I've talked with people there, and they've been talking to Actors Equity, which is the actors union, because it's all very delicate. But my idea is, in New York, there's Columbia, which now didn't have actors when we were there, but has actors now. Juilliard, NYU, all these fantastic acting schools. Why can't there be a cooperation so that they can be part of productions? So I am totally pro-union, and so I'm not taking union jobs. But if there's a 15-character play, can't we have 8 union and 7 students who would love to be on a off-Broadway show, it wouldn't be Broadway, and get their points towards their equity card? And actually, it would be more jobs, because now we have like these 3-person plays. If we did a big play, there would actually be a lot more jobs for equity actors. And then these students, I just feel like it's been such a detriment to the whole oeuvre of American theater. Not every play was meant to be a two-hander. There are some plays that are supposed to be small and some plays that are supposed to be big. And so my play when I went to Liberia a few years ago is 3 acts and I don't know how many people, at least 15. Never been produced, right? There were a couple of theaters that showed interest, but were concerned about the size. And so, but that play is not a small play. It's a huge epic play. It actually goes from the 19th century to the present. And So anyway, that's my idea, which people at the council seem really interested in, but they're right now they're talking, been talking with Equity about showcase off Broadway. So slowly, we hope one day. And so far, Equity's been nice, so because they have new leadership. So we're trying to see. But yeah, I think that's such an issue. You write big plays.
Yeah. No, I mean that's my concern always, you know, you write a sort of a play that's peopled with the people that you know and the world that you see. And for me, it's a multicultural planet. Mm-hmm. And so I see 15 different people, and I'm going to want that to be represented on the stage. And right away you're told, no, you can't mm-hmm. do that. You got to limit it to 5. And the moment you limit it to 5, then in dealing with issues of representation, mm-hmm. you've got problems. If you've got like the one African-American or the one white person or the one Latino mm-hmm. person representing the voice of those groups, you've got a real problem. I've got plays where I mm-hmm. want to have 3 of each because mm-hmm. that's the way I see the world.
And it becomes a different play.
Right, too. It becomes a different yeah. play. But along these lines, just dealing with sort of multiculturalism in American theater, I want to talk about the what's happening with the movement to get more plays by women playwrights.
Yes.
So you can share with us what's been happening
yes.
in New York. I mean, a lot of people know about this, but let's just talk
yes.
some more about that.
This is actually a really kind of surprisingly, is the word successful? Definitely yeah. successful in the sense that things are getting better. They're not, I mean, I always get these numbers mixed up. Okay, 50-50 by 2020, which is the idea that because it all became these polls that were taken, these studies that were taken, and I think the number was
17.
That, yes.
It was 17.
I think it was, 17, 16% of the plays, was it New York or nationally?
It was New York originally.
Yeah.
New York, the NYFA
yeah.
study. But then
16% were directed by women, 17% by written by women. Right. And so all the rest were men. And although I feel funny saying that now because I have a friend who's recently been telling me lots about transgender, so I shouldn't just say black and white, one or the other. So this movement, the thing is, it seems like every 10 to 15 years, or maybe 20, they do like studies like this, and then everybody's mad, and then nothing happens. Or there's like this slow thing, this thing that happens, but then it peters out. But these women, it seems like Julia Jordan especially mm-hmm. has been really spearheading it, a playwright in New York. And it's really seems to be taking off, and there's a lot. Now, I will say, I would like, you know, communities of color to do more of that, because I will say, honestly, most of the increase seems to be a lot of white women for the most part. But I'm still glad to see that happen. My agent told me that he called, this is a year or two ago, he called a literary manager talking about my work, and the literary manager's reaction was, oh, yeah, we don't have enough women in this season this year. And he said he'd never heard that before. It's like, so.
two more questions, and then we'll open it up to the audience. You've been active with Occupy Wall Street and in other efforts around the country. I just wanted to sort of ask you this general question that I think artists, activists always have, which is, where do you think you should go, to the barricades or to the garret? You know, do you go to write or to protest, or is it shouldn't be an either or a construct? You should be able to do both at the same, and one informs the other.
Yeah, I think so. I think you should be able to do both. And when I do,
I guess the question is, which do you think is more effective in the end, from your standpoint?
You know, I can't say one or the other. I will say when I'm just writing, sometimes I feel like I should be out being active. When I'm just being active, I feel like I should be writing. So I think they're both important.
Okay. And so my last question to you is, because you're always so ahead of the game in terms of these issues, dealing with Ritalin or dealing with police brutality and all these other issues. What's next? What are you working on next, and will you, or in the next couple of years?
I'm still recuperating. Oh. It's like... these two plays that I just wrote, I'm sort of, because they were first drafts, my agent has sent Megastasis around to theaters, and I sent the Tort Law play to the actors, so I'm sort of waiting to hear back from them in terms of rewriting and for the next draft. And recently, Anne Bogart, who's a kind of a renowned theater director, got in touch with me because she wants to do a project. She got four black writers. We're just going to do these short plays because she's doing some project about John Henry. So it's me and Regina Taylor and Carl Hancock Rux and, I love it. Hey, what's his name? Oh, God, I'm going blank. That has the play at Near Theater Workshop right now. I'll think of it. He has that the coolest name. I'll think of it. Willpower.
Willpower. All right. Well, let's throw it out to the audience if you have any questions.
I'm unfamiliar with the world of playwriting, but I'm curious as to what you were saying. Maybe you could just explain a little bit more about the issue with equity. And you mentioned the number 5. Is there a magic number that you can have more than 5?
Yes. That's their number.
Some of them say 4 or something. I mean, I write what I'm going to write, and then I watch it get dusty in my drawer because I will say my play that was at Playwrights, A Cool Dip in the Barren Sand Creek. It's called A Cool Dip in the Barren Saharan Creek. This is actually the first time when I probably consciously cut an actor. Which in this case was okay because it was, or I should say, not that I consciously cut it, that I consciously didn't write it, because there are 5 actors, and to have had the other thing would have made 6. It's basically there's a child, and there's a fast forward between Act 1 and Act 2 of time, and if I wanted to bring that child back, it would have required another actor because he would have been a teenager by then. In that case, the challenge actually was okay because I think the way I brought him back in memory, in a weird sort of surreal sort of memory sort of thing, if you even want to call it memory, it's a whole other thing, but it actually was kind of cool. So that was okay. But going from like 15 to 5 is a whole different thing because then it's a totally different play. So there are some ways around it, like colleges, for example, sometimes want to have a lot of roles for their actors, and so you can do that, especially undergrads. Of course, undergrads are only going to have so much acting ability, and if you're writing challenging material, it's a great experience always working with students, but it's, you know, hard to say that that's your ideal production. So, it's about the money.
It's the producers, the artistic directors of these companies. They have 2 piles. I was told this 15 years ago, 20 years ago, that the play scripts that have 5 people or less, and then the other scripts.
I didn't know that.
Yeah, and they'll read these first, and then because of the money, because they're going to have to pay for more actors, and they're going to have to cut into their production budget and a whole bunch of other things that they want to spend money on, not on actors. It's not really the equity folks that are at fault here. It's the artistic directors those choices.
I was probably confusing. Yeah. When I said equity, what I was saying in terms of my idea of bringing students, the students would not be paid. Equity would have an issue with that because they would want to fill those with equity actors. Right. The equity would be fine if they did 15 character plays and had them all equity because they could pay all those actors, but the producers don't want to. Yeah. So I was saying playwrights can write big plays that this might be a solution.
That's one reason why there's no big complaint about doing too much Shakespeare. Because, I agree with it too, because at least we employ our actors, 15, 20 of them at a time.
And that, for a lot of theaters, is a sure bet, a Shakespeare or something, as opposed to a risk of a new play.
I'm not downing Shakespeare.
Horrible things, did you say? No. You know, in some ways it's interesting because the novel, because it's a big-ass epic novel, I think somehow affected me in a more harsh way. I mean, well, partly I think because with a play, I'm reading it, I'm imagining it the way I want to be, but it's never that you get the right actor doing it, and then it becomes, you know, this big thing, because it is a blueprint. Whereas the novel, it's full out. And because it's an epic one, and it goes from 1941 to 2010, so it's these people, it's actually four brothers from youth to old age. So I sort of go through their whole lives. And I don't know that it's a place, but it's, maybe it is. I have to put some sort of padding down or something, because I did have an interesting experience when I wrote the first draft of this novel. I wrote it because I write longhand, so I wrote it. So I had like 20 some notebooks or something of the first draft, but I didn't number them right. So one time, so I typed them in, but I typed it. I was going along typing it. I didn't have to like do it all at once, but I was doing some typing and I thought I missed a line. As it turned out, I didn't. But it felt like in the moment I missed a line. So I was going through all the notebooks. I wasn't sure which notebook it was in. And I happened to pick up the notebook with the climax. And when I picked it up, I went, oh! Like I had this gut reaction because somehow coming at when I wasn't prepared for it, it was really awful. But so I guess I do prepare without realizing it. Yes. Excellent question, and that brings to another political issue of theater, ticket prices. they are outrageous. There have been some movement to lower them. There's a theater in New York called the Signature Theater that now for their basic first run, the first 4 weeks, the tickets go up after it's extended. But for the first 4 weeks, all tickets are $25. And these... I mean, it is not like off Broadway. It is a major theater in New York. And as the artistic director has been quoted as saying, it has changed the audience. So it's much more diversified in terms of color. There are so many people of color. Also in terms of age, because a lot of the people that had money were older people in a lot of the off-Broadways, the subscription audiences. I remember one time in London, I'm not sure if this is still true because that was a long time ago, but somebody told me, or a literary manager there, that they would never go to subscription because they liked audience to pay for the play. So they're going because they want to see that play and not just because it was part of a package. And so that's part of the subscription audiences, which, of course, you can get a discount for each show if you get a subscription, but you got to have the money up front, which is a lot of money. So that's what that it comes down to. And as for audiences that can be very different than what I'm showing, I mean, it's fine with me. I mean, I'm fine with whoever sees the play, but I'm not happy. I mean, meaning that I don't say colored only on the on the audience list, but I want Black people as well to see it. So, you know, a place so actually, at least in their second stage, and I think on their first stage too, I've only done their second stage, is The Goodman, is I see a lot of Black people, maybe because Regina Taylor has been an artistic associate there for all or something. But, and actually Center Stage in Baltimore is pretty good about it. Mm-hmm. So it depends on what theaters, but I have no problem whatever audience member. I am really happy. I mean, I always say I feel like I'm successful if at least one audience member leaves thinking differently than when they walked in, you know, because maybe they'll actually do something, you know. But I would like that to get more diverse. And slowly. There's also other theaters that are offering discounts. Like I think New York Theater Workshop is $20 Sunday evening. So They're slowly, finally getting to getting a little bit of getting on that track. I would like, I mean, this is a little separate thing, but I just may as well say it now. New York is New York City is less than half white, and I would love to see that representation on the stage, and that may also help the audience changing. So I just want to say one other little thing that has nothing to do with this, but I just felt like saying it, which is a zillion years ago, I read Augusto Bao's Theater of the Oppressed, which is about political theater. I read it long ago, so I don't remember a lot of it. But the one thing that stayed with me is he said that if an audience comes into the theater and they leave so devastated that all they can do is throw up their hands in despair, you've really not done anything because nobody's going to make a change then if they just realize it's hopeless. So he suggested giving a little bit of hope, and that's important in all of my plays, but to also have truth. And actually, when I did the Liberia play, I actually went there in 2004 when they were transitioning out of their civil war, and I wrote this play. It was this cool thing where they gave money for travel and then commission for this play, and that was the one time when I thought I couldn't find the hope, because for all intents and purposes, the war was over. I mean, there was definitely, there were bullet holes everywhere, and there was no running water or electricity. And in the bush, where we went for a couple of nights, they didn't know, the rebels didn't know that the war was over, because there was no, you know, information to tell them, no media. So, but for the most part, in Monrovia, the city, people thought it was over. But there was empty pockets everywhere, so everybody was so depressed. And so I actually thought, I can't do this truth and give hope honestly. Well, what happened when I wrote the play, which starts in the 1800s, which is, I'll try to say this really fast, but there's something called the American Colonization Society, which was all about colonizing Liberia.
Henry Clay.
Yes. Here, yeah. And there were, it was all white men. There were some reluctant Quakers and abolitionists, but most of them were Southern planters who had no problem with blacks in bondage. They just wanted to get rid of the free blacks. So it became Liberia. It's interesting because one thought they had was just to go west of the Mississippi, because it would be a lot cheaper than sending them to Africa. But then they were afraid, first, that they may harbor escaped slaves, and also that they may join forces with Canada, Mexico, and Native America and make war in the United States of America. So they sent them to Africa. So the sad irony is Liberia, freedom, that's where the name came from. Monrovia, the capital's from James Monroe. And if you look at the flag, it looks very much like similar to the American flag, the first republic in Africa. But because they went there only knowing the slave master society, that's what they did to the Africans. So it was not slavery technically, but it was indentured servitude for several years. If they went to the bush and a woman had her breasts bare, they would fine her. And I think it was 1787, it became a republic, but women and Africans, who were still 95% of population, couldn't vote till 1946, right? So anyway, so I wrote this play that starts with slavery in the U.S. and then becomes the colonization and then becomes the contemporary time with the war and all that. This long-ass story that I just said, the irony was I just went through that whole process and totally surprised myself, because just the resilience of humanity, I think it is my most hopeful ending ever. And it was what I thought would never be hopeful. It was like, just when I went through the journey, it's what it naturally became.
This has been a presentation of the Kentucky Women Writers Conference and the University of Kentucky. For more information, please visit KentuckyWomenWriters.org.